This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Mark Walker, Republican congressman from Greensboro, witnesses Wednesday's shooting at a congressional baseball practice in Alexandria, Virginia. North Carolina Senator Richard Burr chairs Attorney General Jeff Sessions' contentious hearing. Charlotte unanimously passes its $2.4 billion budget. Mecklenburg County takes a straw vote on theirs. And Republicans in the legislature hope to reach a compromise soon between the Senate and House versions of the state budget and crime, the homicide rate, and other public safety issues may play into Charlotte's mayor's race. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more. Tom Bullock is here from the WFAE newsroom. Glenn Birkins is editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for Roll Call and the NBC BLK and WCCB News Rising. And Eric Spanberg is senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. Good morning to all of you. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Good morning.
You can reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook, where you can also see us today on Facebook Live, or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks using the hashtag WFAE Roundup. Well, it's been an awful week. Last night, the annual congressional baseball game between Democrats and Republicans was played despite that shooting on Wednesday at a Republican practice for the game in Alexandria. The shooting, of course, critically wounded Louisiana Representative Steve Scalise, the House Majority Whip, and several others. And it was witnessed, as I said, by Representative Mark Walker from Greensboro and a congressman from South Carolina. He tweeted, Mark Walker tweeted that he was shaken but okay. And as others have, he credited the quick action and bravery of the Capitol Police detail who were there to protect Scalise. This could have been a massacre had it not been for the presence of those officers who, I think, you, Eric, you pointed out just before we started, took on with pistols a guy with a rifle. Maybe it was you, Mary.
Yes, it was.
It could have been horrible. Talk about the reaction that this has received from members of Congress.
Well, they're again pledging that basically the rhetoric and the incivility has gotten out of hand, and they're going to try to actually disagree without being disagreeable. And in a signal of that, the Democrats who won, the captain of the team, gave the trophy to the Republicans to keep in Steve Scalise's office until he hopefully comes back. But then you went right into more political rhetoric. The president is tweeting about the Russia investigation. Folks are denigrating Robert Mueller and saying that he will be partisan in his investigations. And so there's hope. But then again, will people follow up?
Yeah, the people came together in the immediate aftermath. There were scenes on television of Democratic representatives who have been, I guess, at their own practice, mm-hmm. huddling in prayer for their Republican colleagues. And then Paul Ryan on the floor of the House said an attack on one of us is an attack on all of us, and that was roundly greeted by a standing ovation in the House chamber. But it didn't take long for things to go back to normal.
Well, there's another scene that took place on the House floor, Mike, which I thought was really powerful. And I can't remember which lawmaker it was, but they asked how many of you, meaning his fellow lawmakers in the House, had received some kind of a threat, either threat of violence or death threat. And hands from both sides of the aisle shot up. And it's a powerful moment to remember. And you know, there are a lot of people who are already wondering whether or not this will lead to possibly some more regulations on guns. It's important to note that the person who shot up the Republican field, that practice, bought the guns legally.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was avidly anti-Republican. But the reality is you're also seeing, you know, I listened to a lot of interviews about this, and you're seeing camps just retreat back to their standard lines. You're seeing Democrats saying we need more gun control. You're seeing Republicans say, you know, the only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. Both arguments have their merits. But the reality is until you come together to try to figure out how you can work something out, all they are arguments. Productive? No. You know, idealistic? Sure. Have points? Sure. But we've got to get past just the vitriol, the sides, and get to something where people can sit down and say, you know, wait a second here. Because I do think it's important to point out, we were talking about this also before the show, this wasn't even the only mass shooting on that day. Just hours afterwards, there was a mass shooting at a UPS facility in San Francisco. And I'm guessing there were, you know, at there may have been another mass shooting or some other shootings where it just didn't rise to the level of news given what had happened in those two cities.
Well, and what's go ahead, Glenn.
I would be surprised if this actually leads to any meaningful gun control legislation. We've been here before, mm-hmm. Gabby Giffords, just a few years back. What I fear, actually, is that it might eventually put more of a barrier between our elected officials and the people who put them in office. We're already seeing them shying away from direct interaction with voters at town hall meetings for a completely different reason. But now there's this threat of possible physical violence.
Well, I'm not sure it is just for a completely different reason. I mean, people who don't like the fact that congressmen are not showing up for town hall meetings will say they don't have the courage of their convictions and they don't want to meet their constituents. But there has to be an element of concern and fear in their minds, because guess what? People carry guns to these things now.
Well, I think
and they could use them.
But clearly, what you're referring to, though, Glenn,
fear of facing voters,
right.
Fearing the wrath of voters, not necessarily physical violence.
But now there's a legitimate concern of physical violence, and I think it's somewhat justified, don't you think?
Well, I think we can still have town hall meetings, and we can have security at those meetings.
Yes.
I don't think the answer is to say we're not going to have town hall meetings, and I think what you're also getting at is this idea. There's a lot of discussion now of should congressional offices be located in courthouses so that you have more security, which doesn't limit access. Maybe it makes it a little bit more difficult in some cases. But, I think there are some reasonable ways to deal with the security for members of Congress. But what strikes me is, I go back to what Tom said, is that it takes something that is this dramatic, that is a member of Congress being shot on a baseball field, to sort of break through the news cycle of all the violence that we see every day in this country.
Mary.
Yes, and I was going to say that we need to also point out that even many of the police officers and law enforcement have said this is a mental health issue, mm-hmm. as well, that this country is not doing enough. Because let's face it, a lone person, whatever, you can say it's a political, but they can in their head have any reason. We have a lot of domestic violence and folks with guns going after their partners, coworkers, people who are fired and then go back. And it's because of the anger and not dealing with folks who are seriously ill and disturbed, right. Let's face it. And even, it was interesting. I did see many law enforcement officers saying, we've got to get to the root of that problem.
Yeah. Tom, did you want to jump in here?
I do. Just to follow up on a different idea, though, I understand the fear that's out there on the part of, representatives, congresspeople. But I happened to be an intern on the Washington desk at NPR back in 1998 when the Capitol shooting took place. And in that incident, I believe two Capitol policemen were killed. And what ended up happening changed the dynamic on the Capitol in a very big way. It was always known as the People's House, and you could walk in,
right.
without much of a check.
Right.
Now there are, besides the metal detectors, which honestly I do understand, given the climate,
sure.
but there are so many more hurdles just to get inside a building that was built to represent the people. And I do fear a retrenchment that separates Congress, that separates representatives from the people that have chosen, yeah. Chosen them. And I really do hope, I understand the fear, I'm not downplaying it, but I really do hope that people don't go that track, because all that does is put up an additional barrier between lawmakers and their constituents.
And when I was working in Washington, late at night, I would come home and I would go to do a shortcut. I would go down Pennsylvania Avenue in front of the White House.
Yeah, I can't do that.
Can't do that anymore either. There were calls, of course, immediately to lower the temperature of the rhetoric in Washington and around the country, because that's what's causing a lot of this anger, it seems to me. If you hear a constant barrage of the other side are bad guys and they have evil intent, that's going to make you really, really angry. And if you have a mental problem, that may be processed in a way that's not healthy. And one of those people calling to lower the temperature was Greensboro Congressman Mark Walker.
It has to come from leadership first, top down, administration, members of Congress, that we've got to make sure that our rhetoric is not explosive that it's inciting some of this. Obviously, you can't control everything. You have people with issues, but we've got to make sure that, listen, we don't have to surrender what we believe in, but how we relay that's very important.
But very quickly after that, one Republican blamed Democrats for the kind of speech that led to this incident. He quickly retracted that comment. But who's to blame? Is it apparatchiks, party apparatchiks? Is it pundits? Is it Rush Limbaugh, Fox News? Is it somebody on the left? Who's responsible for this? How do you start whittling this down?
Well, I guess what I fear about this conversation that's going on nationwide is that while I'm not apologizing for the political rhetoric, it is certainly awful in a lot of ways. But it also feels like a little bit of a crutch because really what we're talking about is the mental health of people, the access to weapons. That could go in multiple directions. It doesn't have to be politics. It's almost like when someone's mentally ill, they're looking for a reason.
Mm-hmm. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on WFAE. Tom.
I'm going to have a partial answer to this that our listeners may not like. We are to blame for this in a way that's pretty obvious at times. Whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, when you want to talk about the political rhetoric and temperature of that rhetoric, it's because it's worked to get politicians either elected or reelected. It's because I fear we've grown to become a place where words like compromise or agreement are seen as weakness. And, you know, honestly, if we want to ratchet down political rhetoric, then perhaps it's time to start pushing people to be moderate. And I'm not saying that the public is to blame, but we do play a role. Yeah. And we've got to, you know, the easiest way to change a politician's course is to say, have enough people say, you have to stop this. That's on us.
Glenn. I think another factor that plays into this is social media. It used to be that there was right-wing media and just a little bit of left-wing media. But now social media, Facebook in particular, the algorithm does not encourage you to interact with people who might have different political views. In fact, it's the opposite. If you're left-leaning, it's going to feed you stories. It's going to feed you feeds from other left-leaning people. And so you don't
and hear vice versa.
All, and yeah. vice versa. Yeah. And so you don't hear all sides of any issue.
Right.
And you spend your day getting wound up.
And I don't know that
demonizing.
I don't know that people who are not in the public spotlight understand the danger involved in some of these situations. Democrat Nancy Pelosi has called for Capitol Police to get more resources to protect members and the public. And according to Roll Call, Pelosi said she's received incessant threats throughout her life in public service and won't let her grandchildren answer her phone at home because of the ugly calls that she receives. And I've heard this echoed by our former governor, Pat McCrory, who has been very disturbed by the fact that he and his wife evidently can't walk down the street or go to a restaurant without being verbally accosted, not physically threatened, right. but just called names. That's uncalled for, it seems to me.
Yeah, I think that you hit on it when you said you don't see the other side as human. And I know in even emails that we get as journalists, sometimes the rhetoric is incredible. And occasionally when I will answer back, the person seems surprised that there is actually a human being on the other side.
Right.
And that always stuns me. And when they do, they pull back and say, oh, I didn't mean it the way I said it. But it's because you are thought of not just as incorrect, but as you say, a demon, as wrong, as evil, as terrible. And I do think that that's a problem as well. And, you know, the Congress people and the politicians used to live in Washington and their kids went to school together and they went to church together. But now they go back to their constituencies and that's where they hear, we don't want you, as you said, Tom, to compromise.
There was other news and we'll cover some of that as we go through the hour here, including the contentious Jeff Sessions hearing this week that North Carolina Senator Richard Byrd chaired. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal, Mary C. Curtis, columnist for Roll Call, and appearing regularly on WCCB News Rising, Glenn Birkins, editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com, and Tom Bullock from our newsroom, WFAE News. Partisanship seemed to be on display at the hearing chaired this week by North Carolina Senator Richard Byrd, despite the senator's opening remarks.
Attorney General Sessions, this venue is your opportunity to separate fact from fiction and to set the record straight on a number of allegations reported in the press. I look forward to a candid and honest discussion as we continue to pursue the truth behind Russia's interference in the 2016 elections.
So did any of that happen?
To invoke executive privilege, I'm not going to answer that.
Executive privilege that the president has not invoked.
But he could.
Uninvoked privilege is a whole new phrase, I think, that Jeff Sessions created.
Yes, and he got pretty afraid, you know, the scary black woman, Senator Kamala Harris of California, who got interrupted several times and has become a pretty big media star and a feminist star, the former AG of California.
Yeah. Jeff Sessions displayed several moments of anger over his perception that his reputation had been besmirched, and he seemed to be reluctant to answer several questions, as we've already alluded to, particularly questions, it seems to me, posed by Democrats on the committee. Is that because Republicans were throwing softballs, or was something else at work here?
I wouldn't say softballs to all of them. There certainly were some softballs thrown. I think Senator Tom Cotton threw, you know, a nice slow pitch, easy hit every time. But I also think that, you know, there were some fair questions, without a doubt, from Republicans.
Senator McCain.
McCain. What about, you know, honestly, I think some of Richard Burr's questions were absolutely on the mark. He has been, you know, walking a pretty nonpartisan line. And there will be some people who disagree with me on that point because they want hard, like, get to the point. The problem isn't always the questions. The problem are it's the responses. And what's been fascinating is you have Jeff Sessions, and this is an extraordinary event, the, you know, pretty new on the job Attorney General of the United States testifying before the Senate Intelligence Committee about potential collusion, potential, you know, interference, Russian interference. And he never, first of all, broached the big question I was waiting to find out about. Did he actually offer to resign when President Donald Trump was going after, you know, the feckless Justice Department? That question was never asked. Instead, they kind of just focused on drawing parallels between former FBI Director Jim Comey's testimony and Sessions' view of things. And if you really parse the statements, there are some that are definitive. He says, you know, hey, there was no direct, I did not directly collude with the Russians. But then Sessions fell back on some pretty standard response now that we're seeing, which is, I do not recall, which was his go-to phrase. I think that's fair to say. And then also the, I don't want to, this is what we were talking about before, I don't want to, you know, talk about conversations I've had with the president, which we've also seen from President Trump's Director of National Intelligence and other intelligence officials, where it does seem like it would be very easy for them to answer yes or no without revealing classified information.
Does a lack of answer there indicate an answer?
Absolutely. Absolutely it does. I think if the answer is no, we did not have that conversation, I think we would have heard that. And I think that applies to not just Attorney General Sessions, but others who have taken that position.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think also, you know, the other issue that was glaringly obvious, not reconciled, but will be discussed all summer long, is this idea of he's recused himself from anything to do with Russia, and yet he is making a recommendation to remove an FBI director who the president himself says was removed or fired because of the Russian inquiry. And I never thought Attorney General Sessions gave a good or meaningful answer on that.
There's no way he can talk himself out of that. Yeah.
And there was something else that Jeff Sessions kept doing repeatedly, at least my perception is that it was repeated because I found it odd and or disturbing. He seemed to be unsure about several points of law and several points of policy within the department that he runs. And I was wondering whether that could be true, that he wouldn't know the law or he wouldn't know the policy because he is relatively new in that job, or whether he was skirting the issue. I just couldn't figure it out.
I think it matters on the particular issue because, you know, honestly, you're right. Again, he is new at this job. And even though he's been a sitting senator for, what, 2 decades? And worked for the Justice Department as a prosecutor beforehand, the protocols at that level as Attorney General, they are different. However, you have career people there to teach you the ropes, to show you the ropes, and to answer your questions and guide you. So I think there were times when it's a fair point to bring up, like maybe he really didn't know. But to not know on that level is
particularly
disturbing.
Tom, when you have to believe he was prepped and prepped and prepped before he sat down.
But Eric said he didn't. I mean, that's one thing that I found really strange. You're testifying before the Senate Intelligence Committee on the biggest political hot button issue of the day, and he actually said, I didn't have much time to go back over my notes. Everything was happening so fast. Can you slow down your questions? You're making me nervous.
And at a certain point,
that's right.
That doesn't.
I'm Sandra Harris.
You know, I'm not quite sure what I'm doing, which has been the excuse of a lot of folks in this administration. It just doesn't wash, particularly since there's so much he doesn't recall. I don't know if I met the Russian ambassador or some folks like that, I would remember how many times and where and when. So there's so much that he doesn't recall.
Well,
I don't think that the special investigator is going to take some of these folks. I don't recall. I can't talk about it as an answer. So I don't think we've heard the end of it.
And still there is that. I know it's an obvious question. Senator Reid asked it a couple times, which he repeated the statements that were made praising Jim Comey during the campaign by not only Sessions, but Donald Trump. And then lo and behold, you get to May and you decide that he should be fired based on the way that was handled.
I think the more what was also just kind of interesting to me and surprised me when he did have kind of a paucity of answers for some fair questions from both sides of the aisle is the fact that let's remember Jeff Sessions is the one who wanted this to be, almost insisted that this be a public hearing. So he knew he was going before television cameras and the American people. He wasn't talking behind closed doors. He wanted this in person. And, you know, there are some out there that were arguing, well, he did that as a way to kind of cloche his responsibility to answer fully. Mm-hmm. Because if you're in public, there are certain things you can't talk about. But regardless of which, the preparation that you would think would be made.
But how much of that is maybe due to the fact that he served so long with these people as colleagues in the Senate, he didn't feel he needed to
prepare. I actually disagree with that, because if you go back to his confirmation hearing, it was not a rosy run.
Yes, he should remember Senator Franken, I think. That wasn't that long ago.
Well, he told Senator Franken they're friends, I guess, and their wives are friends, but he said he told them to eat his Wheaties before he got there.
That's right, he did.
The House committee looking into all of this seems relatively dysfunctional.
That's kind of you.
Thank you. The Senate committee, are they making any headway? And is North Carolina Senator Richard Burr particularly distinguishing himself as the chairman of this committee?
I personally think he's doing as good a job as you could do right now, given the polarized nature of this. There are going to be, you know, Democrats who say he's not doing enough. But even Mark Warner, who is the ranking member of that committee, a senator from Virginia and Democrat, he and Burr have been like side by side. It's almost like a buddy movie going through this. And you know what? I think it's working. It is certainly more functional than the House. And the House committee is, I mean, it's just a mess of politics. And now it's going to be headed by Trey Gowdy, the representative from South Carolina.
Of Benghazi fame.
Exactly. So we'll see if that cleans things up at all.
Well, you know, our standards have gotten pretty low for behavior when we look at competence and the fact that a Democrat and Republican are talking who are on the committee as the high bar of, achievement.
But I think that's a great, point, Mary. That's really so true.
And the other low bar that Tom pointed out is the fact that just the fact that I lost my thought.
Well, let me.
They're both from swing states. Both from purple states.
Let me bring up what you're thinking. I would love to hear what you say. This is the moment where I thought, okay, you know, Richard Burr is doing a good job, in my personal opinion. It goes back to Comey's testimony, and anybody who missed the first line of questions, and Richard Burr starts as the chairman of the committee. His whole series of "Do you have any doubt?" questions established something that I think has been forgotten in all of this. It was all focused on did Russia play any role in trying to meddle with this election, not with votes, but with perceptions.
Right.
And that series of questions and answers by Comey is absolutely riveting. And if there are people who doubt Russia tried to do something, they should go to that and they should watch it.
So Glenn has rebooted now and is ready to go.
What I was going to say is that when you look at how badly the House investigation is going, that's the other low bar. By comparison, the Senate looks absolutely investigatorial by comparison.
You can't fall off the floor, Glenn.
You really can't. I agree. I think Burr has acquitted himself well. Frankly, I think he has been much more aggressive than I thought he would be going in. Mm-hmm. I never thought that I would see him standing with a Democrat as Eric points out or Tom pointed out almost as buddies. I think he's done a relatively good job, but I keep reminding myself that maybe I'm just grading on the curve because the House is is in such disarray.
Well, he's playing to the home state, and North Carolina has shown that it's tight in battlegrounds, and they probably, you know, he wears well, I think, and he always comes in under the radar, and he always wins.
So let's bring this conversation 500 miles south to Charlotte, because the city, where the city council this week approved unanimously the city's $2.4 billion budget for next year. Is that unusual, this unanimous approval?
It might be a little bit. I mean, usually they've hashed this out, in the straw vote, so you're going to have a pretty healthy majority. What I would say about this one is this is probably as easy as they come, because you have all this construction going around, which is lifting tax revenue. And so they were able to increase spending in some areas that citizens consider important, they consider important, and do it without a property tax hike. And so what could be a better start to summer in an election year than that?
But they are increasing. They're not increasing property taxes, no increase in property taxes. And they're adding police and firefighters, and they're giving raises to city employees. But they are increasing fees for water and trash pickup. About $26.76 a year was the
fee
that I read.
Yeah.
So all the money to raise salaries, to increase the police and fire department forces, that's all coming from
added revenue.
Revenue from construction and
you can thank the millennials filling up the apartments that are being built all around town.
Wow. Okay.
Now in 5 years, we might lament the demand on services and what we have to pay, but for the moment, it's a good situation.
So this budget includes a 3% pool, whatever that means, for merit pay raises for salaried city employees, and it raises the minimum starting salary to $15 an hour, which hits a goal to do that ahead of schedule by about 2 years. And they adopted a $4.1 billion capital budget for 2018 through 2022 called the Community Investment Plan.
That's an ongoing series of investments.
What's in that?
And they appear every other year before voters on the ballot, and it's a range of roads, bridges, neighborhood improvements, those kinds of things. And this is standard. I mean, the city is always doing this. They do it in, you know, 6 year cycles generally, 6 to 8 year cycles. And so this is standard stuff. And it is usually pretty milquetoast, non-controversial. Although, as I say that, on the county side, the capital improvement that includes parks and greenways was a little bumpier this past week.
I think it's interesting that the city's budget is $2.4 billion. The county's budget's $1.7 billion. Why the discrepancy? It seems to be should be the other way around.
That's a good question. I don't have an instant answer to that, although the city tends to do more than the county does. The county is pretty focused on
the
social
offers more direct
health,
services to its residents than the county does.
And so that, I think that's the basic answer is you're doing water, fire, police.
So Mecklenburg County Commission took a straw vote on their budget, which, as I said, is $1.7 billion, and they agreed they liked the budget with some additions. What are some of those additions? I have them in case you
okay, good. Yeah, tell me.
In case I've stumped the
Yes,
panel.
You have stumped me because I don't remember the additions.
$248,000 for HIV prevention.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry.
$258,000 for a smoking cessation option.
Okay.
And $322,000 for short-term housing for the homeless. What's this smoking cessation?
It's just adding on to your continuing programs.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of this stuff actually, I think the HIV prevention is interesting. For two reasons, we are seeing both here in Charlotte and nationally an increase in HIV infection rates again because a lot of the early prevention and fear, frankly, over the disease has waned as it's become more a part of life and it's you know, it can be treated almost, not complete, but almost as a chronic disease.
Yeah. And Charlotte has a problem with STDs.
They
period.
Do. And yes. I mean, we talked about this actually the other week when we were talking about Plesha's resignation. So I do think that that's a positive step. But overall, again, with the county, I think the everything here just seems to be, again, we're flush with cash. We've got a little controversy in the parks, you know, with the soccer stadium, but it's pretty straightforward.
It's the local news roundup this morning on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Again, this budget, if approved, proposed no property tax increase, which is a good news for people who own homes, I suppose. County Manager Dina DiIorio has recommended that the entire CMS capital plan, $1 billion, will go before voters in a November referendum. What would that package do?
Well, you're building some new schools, obviously.
New schools.
You're improving
a bunch of old ones.
Yeah, you're renovating. Obviously, we have a number of aging schools. The most interesting part about this, of course, is that they added those couple of schools at the end to get the necessary votes from the county commission to put it on the ballot. And you heard a little bit of squabbling about that again. I suspect that will be really the main focus of dissent when we get into October, November. School bond packages have been largely successful here. Glenn and Mary, y'all may have been here. I know you were, Mike, when the one that was rejected, how long ago was that?
Surprise when it happened.
It was shocking.
Shocking.
But ever since, they've all gone through. So, I would think it has a pretty good chance, but that's going to be an interesting debate about the expansion that added those schools.
Well, it also comes at a time with the reassignment plan, and that could be souring the water a bit for some voters.
Sure.
I'm curious to watch it.
That, of course, would come in some of this would come in a form of a bond, and people always get confused about bonds and where that money comes from, because that's essentially debt that has to be paid back with interest. Could that be done without any future property tax increases? Can you pay back that debt without raising taxes later on? Or are we just kicking the can down the road here?
No, you could. I mean, functionally, it's like balancing your checkbook. You can pay off your credit card without having to get a second job if you manage your money well. It's basically the same kind of idea.
Right. It depends on what else you're doing in the future.
Exactly.
And it's going to depend in large measure on the economy as well.
Right.
Right now, we're riding a great economy, as we've pointed out. Construction everywhere, people moving in. If the economy goes south, that could change in a hurry.
Some of the things that they're doing in this budget are likely to help county employees who have a baby or who need time off from work to adopt a child or be away from work to take care of somebody in their family, like an elderly member of their family or a wife or a husband, by giving employees 6 weeks of paid family leave. The city just added 6 weeks of paternity leave to their budget. Is this 6 weeks per year or per lifetime of employment? And I have 10 seconds.
Per baby.
All right. We're coming right back with more at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Tom Bullock is here from WFAE News. Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call. Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. Wave, Eric. We're on Facebook Live. Wave at the camera.
There we go.
And Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com. We're going to wrap up on the county budget, which does a lot of different things without raising property taxes, including giving time off to workers. And the city budget does this too. Workers who have a baby or they need to have take care of a parent or somebody else in their family. The county budget, as it stands, earmarks $15 million more next year for CMS, meaning the schools will get more than $400 million from the county. Is that as much as they asked for? Because they don't usually get what they
asked. I believe they asked for 28, didn't they?
27.
So, yeah, they asked for 27. And we've mentioned on this show many times, it's an annual dance at this point. They ask for more, they get less, and we see what happens.
So one thing that didn't make the county budget, and that is the stadium. For Major League Soccer, they originally had $118 million in the budget to transform Memorial Stadium into a soccer stadium, and they called for partnering with the city on this. But city leaders have not said much about that partnership. And in January, the city nixed a vote on providing the money, at least in the short term. What does all this mean?
Well, it means that the bid for an MLS franchise is going very poorly this summer, I think is what it means. And just one small point, they would not renovate Memorial Stadium. They would knock it down and build a new stadium, $175 million. So, as you say, the city council opted not to vote in January. They were worried about the rushed manner of it and the way it looked, given all the other priorities. And the city really hasn't done anything since. And now we're heading into July when they file for the fall elections. And so it's looking more and more doubtful that the city will do anything. And if they do agree to do something, it will probably be less than half of the $44 million that was originally requested. So it's all up in the air. August 2nd is the date for the county to reconsider whether
they're going to reconsider based on what the city does. Is the city likely to do anything in that time frame?
At the moment, it doesn't look like they are. Remember, they only have one meeting in July,
right.
And then you would get into the August 2nd vote. There is a site visit that is supposed to happen with the MLS executives, so that's going to tell us a lot about whether there is any appetite to provide the public funding.
So is there a deadline for this as far as Major League Soccer is concerned?
That's all been very wishy-washy, too. This started in mid-December, 12 cities. You have to have everything in place by January 31st. Well, obviously, Charlotte doesn't, and there are other cities that don't have their funding in place completely for the stadium. So it's a little bit of a mess, although the MLS has been pretty definitive that they will select two cities sometime late in 2017.
In cities that have franchises, are they rolling in the dough?
Rolling in the dough, but the league is growing at a pretty healthy clip. Their attendance league-wide was about 21,000 per game. Their interest, their television viewership is not great. That's probably their weakest link. But overall, the league has grown very successfully, and the way you can tell that is the franchise fees are going up.
Okay. Meanwhile, Republicans who control both houses of the legislature are trying to work out the differences between the House and Senate versions of the state budget. Where does that stand?
Well, it's not as far as along as they would like it to be. The original word was we would see something of a compromise deal at the end of this week, meaning Friday. Nothing yet. On Thursday, House Speaker Tim Moore said, maybe Monday, maybe Tuesday, maybe Wednesday, maybe Thursday, all references to next week. And it is clearly going slowly. What is still clear is both the House and the Senate have agreed on the amount that they're going to spend. And they were supposed to be able to fast-track this budget this year because a lot of reports said that the Senate came out with their budget first, the House followed, but the House had budget negotiators in with the Senate negotiators while they were hammering out their own budget. So it looks like this dream of speeding this through is pretty much mirage, but it could still be far better than it's been the last few years.
I was going to say, there's still
it's gone well past deadline.
Of course, the governor always submits his own budget, which in this case would be dead on arrival because he's a Democrat.
They're always dead
on
arrival.
Well, McCrory's were too. Yeah.
Not that it matters, because his veto could easily be overridden, but you spoke with the governor this week, Tom. Would he veto this or would he sign it?
I pushed him on that point, and it's specifically because Governor Cooper's budget basically calls for taxes to be left as they are. He does have a small, well, it's not small, he does have a tax cut for child care. But you look at the Senate plan, which is they passed it early and they gave it this grand title, the $1 billion middle class tax cut.
Billion, Tom. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And then you have the House plan, which is more like a, you know, depending on the math, about a $450 million to $500 million tax cut. What's clear is the House and Senate want a major tax cut again. Mm-hmm. So I pushed Governor Cooper to see if he would veto it, and he basically said it matters on which tax cuts go through. He doesn't want to prejudge it. He kind of squiggled around on that one, I would say.
You spoke to Governor Cooper about several different topics. One was redistricting. The Supreme Court has decided that voting districts as drawn by the legislature are illegal, and he wants a redrawing of those districts to happen sooner rather than later. Why?
Well, he wants it for the obvious reason up front, which is, again, the U.S. Supreme Court has agreed that 28 legislative districts in North Carolina are illegally drawn on racial lines. They're racial gerrymanders. And this much we do know hands down. They will have to be redrawn. So he's originally said, let's do this now. We don't want to have another budget passed. Right. We don't want to have another legislative session with illegal districts in place. I pushed him on that a little bit, though, because the Republicans have said, we're just waiting for something else to happen. They're waiting for a lower court to tell them when it has to happen. But this is what the governor said may be behind that slow motion.
But the reason they want it to take time is because it's quite possible that the maps that they pass again are not constitutional. So they want to drag this thing out so it's bumping up against the next election. What we're talking about here is whether the legislature draws these maps or the court does. And if these maps aren't drawn quickly, I would hope that the court would do it.
Hmm. Interesting.
And there are, it's funny, when I posted that quote on Twitter, I know, be careful with what you post on Twitter, but I was fascinated by the response that I got from both sides. Democrats saying, yeah, that's exactly right. Republicans saying, no, they're looking for, they're just looking for guidance. This is just partisan. What was partisan was the response. But there is the chance, whether on purpose or not, that those boundaries do not meet court-mandated guidance. So, you know, I mean, this is one of those points we could debate for an entire hour and still not resolve.
You also asked him about something that for some, it's a hope that will never die, and that is killing I-77's toll lanes. In the past, he has said that he generally opposes toll roads and that he would not have signed the contract had he been governor when it went through. But he pointed out, or you pointed out, that subsequent statements take the governor in a different direction.
What has happened is that millions of dollars worth of construction has gone into the project thus far. And before immediately canceling the contract, you have to know what the liability of the state is. I think when the contract was entered into and the problems that we saw before the construction started, that would have been the time. But now we are in it, and it's important for us to know what all of our options are.
So do you think after a review we'll have any options that make sense in terms of getting out of the contract now that the thing is under construction and about, what, a year away from more or less from opening?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. Tom and David Borex and I were talking about this the other day at the station, and really I think what's going to happen, what all of us I think is going to happen, is there are going to be some minor adjustments and tweaks to at least improve the contract in the eyes of those who are upset about it. But I don't think there's any way it's going to be killed. I just don't think the project is going to be abolished, so to speak.
And to be precise, I actually played a cut of Governor, well, then candidate Cooper, right, from the first gubernatorial debate that was held here in Charlotte. And he said definitively, yes, he would cancel the contract. You know, this is a company that has gone bankrupt, that they've hired former McCrory campaign staff to, you know, the innuendo there was to help speed this thing through. But, you know, under Cooper's own logic, if he is so dead set against tolls, if he thinks this is a bad project, he should have canceled it sooner.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
as this goes along, more construction is done, the cost could potentially rise.
Well, you knew when they hired the consultant that in essence said, we're not going to kill it. We'll try and salvage whatever we can from it. So it's trying to give a little bit of an answer to everybody.
And no one will be happy.
Right, of course. Exactly. Not. There was a bill working its way through the legislature prior to the shooting in Washington this week at that baseball practice, and actually just outside of Washington in Alexandria. That bill would eliminate the need for concealed carry permits for guns. And here's what the governor told you about that bill.
This legislation troubles me greatly. Law enforcement, many people in law enforcement are very concerned about it, that it may endanger people's safety. I'm hoping the Senate will not take it up and pass it.
Has there been any comment from anyone in the legislature since the shooting in Washington about the fate of this bill?
Specifically about the fate of this bill, no. At least not that I am aware of. I'll take the Jeff Sessions line and say not that I do not recall. But no, and you know, to be clear, I want to clarify just one thing. This does not eliminate concealed carry permits. It all but eliminates the need for them. There are still some situations where a gun owner may want to get one. But another thing the governor pointed out, which is something that we and others have reported, is this bill passed the House by such a small majority.
Right.
That it would not withstand, if that vote held, it would not withstand a veto by the governor. So I'm curious to see what happens because of that vote with the Senate, although the Senate is far more conservative.
CMPD Chief Kerputney has indicated that he's wary of that bill relaxing concealed carry restrictions, although he refuses to say outright whether he supports or opposes the legislation, which is odd to me. He told a town hall meeting that North Carolinians don't need more laws that could lead to more shootings by irresponsible gun owners. Any indication that concealed carry gun owners are any less responsible than those who have
quite the contrary
showing?
Concealed carry gun owners have to go through this very long process. They tend to be far more responsible. That's not the issue here. The issue is if you get rid of the need for the concealed carry training and everything else, that allows anyone over the age of 18 to conceal carry a weapon in public, you know, that's the broader issue. I still think, and I know we talked about this last week or the week that it happened, so forgive me for repeating myself, but I still think the most interesting argument about this came from a Republican representative, Faircloth, who used to be the chief of police in High Point. And his concern is you could have an 18-year-old who has no felony, you know, record at all, walking around with a backpack full of handguns, and he happens to be, you know, he was picked by, say, the example that Representative Faircloth used was gang members. So he could be standing near them in public with an arsenal and a backpack that they could then run to get and use, but also use him to shield them from police who may stop them. They have felony records. If they're caught with a handgun, that is a charge.
Right.
But just the idea of making it legal for 18-year-olds to walk around with concealed weapons or weapons of concealed or not concealed is absolutely ridiculous, given the fact that they aren't legally permitted to drink alcohol, but they would be, under this legislation, allowed to
and
carry.
And, you know, more people will have them, too, because they'll say, I don't want to be the one caught without a gun when everybody is
packing. What's the rationale for decreasing the requirement or eliminating the requirement for training for people who have a concealed carry weapon? What's the rationale for that? Why wouldn't you want them to be trained?
I mean, I think that gets into the issue of the gun debate overall about having licensing and training and more rigorous requirements to make people safer with the weapons.
It's the local news roundup this morning on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. You know, the crime and guns and the homicide rate and the fact that the homicide rate is up in Charlotte, the crime rate is up in Charlotte. It's beginning to creep into the mayor's race. And here's part of a campaign commercial for the lone Republican in the race, Kenny Smith.
Crime in Charlotte is out of control, and our current mayor, Jennifer Roberts, is failing us. Just this year alone, violent crime has increased by nearly 15%, and murders are up a shocking 111%. We can all agree Charlotte deserves better.
Of course, we can all agree that percentages can be deceiving. And although both the homicide and crime rate percentage-wise are up, they are still at historic lows. Do you think the public understands that?
No.
No, it's what they feel. It's what they feel, and there's a sense that, yes, it's out of control. And it's interesting because the areas that I think are least affected are the most worried, because the studies have shown it's mainly folks who know one another. And so the traditional more frisking and harsher punishments wouldn't go to that.
But Joel Ford, who is running against Mayor Roberts along with Vi Lyles on the Democratic ticket, he's also used crime and the increase in crime as a prod for voters. How much control does the mayor of Charlotte
now you're getting to the crux
over
of the issue.
Crime?
Zero.
I mean, yeah, I mean, this is, remember, again, mayor of Charlotte is a part-time job. Let's just start there. They don't vote. You know, it is, I guess, somewhat of a bully pulpit because you speak to the media and you give your opinion. But I find it a long stretch to say that the mayor really has much of an impact. Any mayor has much of an impact on the crime rate.
But here's the thing. It's you're electing someone you hope does something or you believe can do something. Here's something that I'm still amazed people don't get overall, which is we tend to almost always the number one issue in a presidential election is what? It's the economy, right? Remember the classic phrase, it's the economy, Stu? Yeah. Guess how much control the president of the United States has over the
very
U.S.
little
economy.
Yeah. Yeah, but we don't elect Janet Yellen, so I guess we...
So crime and violence and gun violence and the homicide rate, it's all playing into this race. And we had this incident in Washington this week, and now it's the two-year anniversary of the church shooting in Charleston. And I know, Mary, you were in Charleston. What is the atmosphere there on this two-year anniversary of this?
Well, it's interesting. My husband and I went down for the Spoleto Festival, and I say Charleston is a place where the heat and history can be oppressive.
20 seconds.
And we went by, and of course there's more protections there. We looked at Mother Emanuel. You can't get away from that feeling, particularly in that city, and people do think about it. But they also want to go and enjoy the festival. They want to get past it. Are we doing enough as a society to go to the root cause of what caused it in the first place?
Mary C. Curtis is a columnist with Roll Call, among other publications. Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer, frequent host of this program. With the Charlotte Business Journal, Glenn Birkins, editor, publisher of QCityMetro.com, and Tom Bullock, reporter for WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.